This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is brought to you by the Expert Institute. Expert Institute is your one-stop shop for all of your expert needs to help you work up, prepare, and win your case at trial. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. Our show today is also sponsored by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used by my law firm and by law firms all over the country to help manage their personal injury, medical malpractice, complex tort, MDL class action cases. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. And by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a full-service digital marketing firm with great web development, great aesthetics to help you market your law firm. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. My name's Ben Gideon. Rahul is off today. He's going to be giving an opening statement in a trial in Las Vegas that starts today. So good luck, Rahul. I'm thrilled today to invite Philip Miller to join us on the show. I met Philip in his role as a trial consultant when one of my colleagues went to watch him speak at a seminar and came back and said, you've got to hire this guy to help you on a case. We did that, and Philip came up to Maine and spent 2 days with us working up a case, and it was incredibly valuable to me, Philip, to have your help on that case. We didn't know we got a great result, but it just brought so much value to have your perspective on that, and the methodology you taught me in terms of working up cases and thinking them through prior to trial is something I've continued to use in all of my cases since we worked together. So welcome. And thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here this morning.
So before we get into what you're doing today, your trial consulting and practice, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, background, and what brought you into the world of trial law? And I should point out you're in Nashville, Tennessee. That's where you're based.
I am. And I always say, I do not listen to country music.
But we were talking before I went on the air about how my wife and I just went there for our 20th anniversary and got to see Garth Brooks at the Ryman, and we really enjoyed it. That whole scene down there with all the honky-tonks on the strip is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's a real blast. When I say I don't listen to country music, I mean, the first assumption used to be, if you were from Nashville as well, you must listen to country music. And I grew up listening to, I'm an Army brat, so I grew up all over the United States, went to elementary school in five different states. But I grew up listening to rock and roll and pop and blues and that kind of stuff. So I never really developed an ear for country music. And then when I moved here after finishing a master's degree, I was in Nashville and, I was already, my musical tastes were already kind of set. So I just never developed an ear for it. And I know a bunch about it because I have my baby sister is married to a famous country music songwriter who's in the Country Music Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And I have a lot of respect for him. He's a great wordsmith.
What are some of the songs, or can you share that with us?
Yeah, he wrote since Paul Overstreet. He sold for this. He wrote a song called "Forever and Ever, Amen," which he got a Grammy for. And then I think he did a song called
George Strait, right?
Randy Travis.
Okay.
Randy Travis, and then he did another one for Randy Travis called "Digging Up Bones." He wrote a song called "Love Can Build a Bridge," which was done by the Judds. He did a song famously that was done by Kenny Chesney called "She Thinks My Tractor Is Sexy."
That's a good one.
And so I've got great stories. He's a great wordsmith. And I learned something, I think, that translates into what we can talk about, what everybody should think about when they think about their own cases. Because I had Paul come to a convention for the Tennessee trial lawyers, and his topic was storytelling, if you will, because the question is, how do we find the hook in our cases that is going to resonate with jurors, or in his case, resonate with listeners? And so we brought him in to talk about songwriting, and he brought his guitar, he played a few songs. But in the process of that, we had some open questions, and someone asked, how many co-writers have you had on your songs? And he said 27 number one hits, I think. And when they asked him how many co-writers he's had on a song, his answer was hundreds. And that prompted me to think about creativity. So I read a couple of books about creativity. And the fact is that most people, if you look at artists, poets, the rest of it, most people get to their creative limit in terms of they exhaust their real creativity by the time they're in their mid-20s. And see, the only way you can really be creative after that is you have to collaborate with someone else. So we have examples of songwriters and artists who are productive late in life, but the way they're productive is they're collaborating with someone else. They're having someone else stimulate their own creativity. So they're looking at things in a different way, way differently than they would ever think of by themselves. And so Paul has been a prolific songwriter because he has constantly collaborated with other people. And they say something, and that stimulates something in him that never would have occurred otherwise, and vice versa. So collaboration is the piece that very often I think most lawyers miss when they're working on a case. They understand the law. They understand what they have to prove. They know what a prima facie case is. They understand maybe what the problems are. But if they're going to really be creative, they got to get somebody else in there. And there's several ways to do that. I mean, one of the reasons, quite frankly, one of the reasons that focus groups are effective for people who really have an understanding of what they're good for is they sort of open up that creative vein and allow lawyers to think about their case differently in a way that may be more effective and successful than if they're just kind of doing the very best they can within their own head. And so I sometimes refer to this as sort of the songwriter analogy, because the way songwriters are effective over the long term is collaboration. And the way, I think it's exactly the same thing for lawyers. The way you're effective over the long term is really probably going to be collaboration.
That's such a valuable insight, and it's proven so correct to me in my career. I mean, you just get so close to things and you're unable to get yourself out of that box that you're in without somebody prodding you. And whether that's a focus group or a big data study or working with someone like you who can come in with a fresh perspective and bring that to the table, I just think you're absolutely right about that. The other interesting insight is probably that every good plaintiff's case could be boiled down to a country music song. That would probably make a good speech, because I think that's probably true, but it would take a lot of work, you know?
It would take a lot of work.
But just the way country music songs are written with kind of a moral theme to them and a catch, something that's resonant, but is always, there's a story in country music that's different from, in many cases, pop or rock. That's the whole point of country, as I always understood it, was kind of tell a story. That's what we're trying to do.
There's probably some exceptions to that, but my brother-in-law, Paul, is a great storyteller. So all of his songs are about whether it's She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy or Some Beach Somewhere, or there's always some sort of story associated with him. And I remember when he's married to my baby sister, who's 6 years younger than I am, and she's a really smart, strong woman, you know, and six kids, C-sections on all of them, homeschooled all six of them. But I went out to the farm where they live, and there was three kids, and they were just like stair-step. And Paul said, "Hey, Flip, I wrote a new song." I said, "Oh, yeah, what is it?" He says, "When Mama's not happy, nobody's happy." And the three little kids all nodded their head up and down.
That's funny.
And so that's an example of a universal truth. When Mama's not happy, nobody's happy. And so my friend, or better said, probably acquaintance, Peter Perlman from Lexington, Kentucky, started collecting song titles 40 years ago. And the idea behind it is, if this is a song title, this is a song that has resonated with tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands or more people, then if I can find a way to use it in my case, I am, because it's going to resonate with them. And so one of the best things you could do if you could run into Peter is give him a song title that would make sense to your case and be consistent with what we know as a song that was effective. Like, so I think the only one I gave him was, "You don't have to be a weatherman to tell which way the wind blows," that's a Bob Dylan line.
Yeah.
And so, but that's what he would do. And those are examples of song titles that resonate with jurors. And so, yeah, I think you can get ideas from other people, including songs, And if they resonate with jurors, then that's a great way to communicate with them about, it's not a story, but it's one part of your case. And I think that's something that we have to, you know, we can be awfully structured and academic in the way we do things, or we can start to think about how would an ordinary person talk about this who's not burdened with all of the things that we think we have to do. So as an example, I have a client that I do quite a bit of work for, and they routinely send me their direct and cross exams for trial. And when they send me a direct exam, in fact, I just reviewed one yesterday, they spent dozens of hours on this exam. I mean, it's just dozens and dozens of hours, edited video and the rest of that. And when I look at it, because I just don't know anything about the case. I mean, I know about the case, but I don't really know that much about the case. And I'm looking at it and said, well, you know, there's 19 slides. Do we really need these five? And the answer is no, we probably don't. I mean, the answer is, I don't know. I say, I don't think we need these. Do we need these? And they say, no, we don't need them. But there's sort of, what happens is you're kind of in the weeds and unavoidably in the weeds when you were that close to the end, when you have that much time. You know, if you have 40 hours in a deposition, preparing for a deposition, cutting it down to 10 minutes is tough. If you're sort of naive to that whole thing and you don't have as much invested in it, it's a lot easier to say, well, these are the only things that really are important.
I know you are a trial lawyer by training. You've tried many cases and have done that for many years. And then you at some point transitioned to also doing trial consulting where you would help other lawyers put their cases together for trial. How did you make that transition? Why did you do that?
I was teaching for AAJ. And the reason I got into teaching for AAJ was it was just the way for me to continue to get sort of CLE time and learn without having to pay tuition. And so if I could get into the loop of sort of being on faculty for programs, that means I could attend them for free. And whenever I attended one of the CLE programs, I learned things. And of course, what I didn't think about at the time is what I was also learning was that whole collaboration piece, because everybody who was on faculty, and many of those people became really good friends. I knew them for years and years and years. You know, they were doing the same kinds of cases I was in many ways, and sometimes different. And then they were doing things, some of the same things I was doing, they were doing them differently and more effectively. So that whole process was really an evolutionary way to kind of grow myself as a trial lawyer and grow my practice, is that constant stimulation of other people doing the same thing, perhaps in different ways, and other ways of thinking about the same kind of case. And so in the process of doing that, I met a guy named Rodney Jew. And Rodney is a trial consultant starting off in Palo Alto, California, and now in Napa. And I probably met him in the late 90s, in 1999. I mean, I had a real rapport with Rodney in terms of understanding what he was trying to do, because some of what he did at that time was kind of consultant speak. I developed a relationship with him, and then he had a series of big cases. I mean, they were just, when I say big cases, they bring in a team. And there'd be five lawyers on the team, and then there'd just be Rodney. And it was just overwhelming, kind of, really, to maintain the focus and concentration that goes on what he does for 5 days if it's just you and then there's five lawyers. So he brought me in, and for 2.5 years, I leased an apartment in Palo Alto, and I leased a car, and I was there 2 weeks a month. I'd be there for a week. These people would come in with these really big cases and a big litigation team, and then I'd go home a week. And it was so in the process of that, before that, he had brought me in periodically, like he had a flap procedure on his epiglottis at one point. He was afraid he couldn't talk, so he brought me to work in with him with a client on a medical malpractice case. So I learned his methodology, his process of looking at cases. And so it was easy for me to kind of fit in with what Rodney did, because I thought the same way that he did. And then I brought other things in that weren't necessarily part of his toolbox, like the whole concept of depositions, because when we did a work session with clients, we'd say, here's what we need to rebut this terrible landmine that we have uncovered. And they would say, well, we've got it right here. And then when you actually look at the deposition, it really wasn't there, or it wasn't really there in a way that was going to be very persuasive. And so I was in the midst of, at that point, very soon after that, writing a book about advanced deposition strategy and practice, which is published by Trial Guides. And the significant part about that was that these people were good lawyers, but they weren't particularly good at taking depositions, even though they may be. I mean, we did a water rights case that was hundreds of millions of dollars, for example. And the depositions really weren't that good. They didn't really, you know, they kind of learned as they went along, as most lawyers do, on how to take depositions. And so when we got down to the nitty gritty, we're looking at all the things that can cause us to lose the case. And here they are. I said, how do we make those irrelevant or immaterial? Well, that should have been in the deposition, right? But it's not. Or they think it is, but it's not. And so sort of depositions and storytelling is what I brought into the mix when I worked with Rodney, and they both fit in with what he was already doing. So it was a nice fit for us.
Can you talk a little bit about the approach? You said you learned Rodney's approach to how to work up or help lawyers improve their cases. Is there a kind of name for that or an overall?
I think it's reverse planning is probably the proper term for it, which is that we think that we have to prove a prima facie case to win. And we do. We have to prove a prima facie case to get past motions for summary judgment, motions for directed verdict. We have to prove prima facie cases. We need to know what the elements are. But you can prove a prima facie case on every case anywhere in the United States and still lose the case. How is that possible? Right? And the answer is if we don't take out the landmines in the case, the things that if the jurors believe are true, there's always things that the jurors are going to believe are true, tend to believe are true. If we can't take those out, if we can't make them irrelevant or material, we lose the case. Even if we've made out a prima facie case, we prove the prima facie case all day long, and there's some landmine there that we haven't taken out to the satisfaction of jurors, and we lose the case. And so the methodology is, well, let's identify all the landmines. Everything is going to cause us to lose the case first. Then figure out how we're going to take it out, how we're going to make it irrelevant or immaterial. Because if we can't, if we go through and we're just ritually going through the things we know we have to prove, but we've ignored some landmine, then we may lose the case regardless of whether we made out a prima facie case or not. So here's the easiest example. So at one time, Atla at the time did a whole bunch. I mean, a whole bunch. I mean, 20, 30, 40 focus groups on the same fact pattern was a failure to diagnose breast cancer case. And you'd make out a prima facie case. And what would happen is, you know, what's happened, a woman goes in for an examination. She has a palpable mass. They do a mammogram. It just looks like it's fibrocystic disease. She's sent home. She calls about the results for the mammogram. And the lady on the phone says, oh, it was clean or whatever. Well, they're supposed to schedule her for a biopsy because she had a palpable mass. Never scheduled her. She goes home, comes back a year later, and she's stage 4 cancer in her breast. Ends up dying because it metastasizes. And her husband has this lawsuit. So, you know, you have all your experts, you establish causation, breach of the standard of care. And the question the jurors have is, where's the husband? Why didn't he get her to take a second? Why didn't he get her to have a second opinion? Why didn't he have her go back? Did he not know she had a mass in her breast? I mean, what's he going to do with this money? Does he have a girlfriend? I mean, all of that stuff is sometimes called juror proof. But the fact is, it's also a landmine. In the front end, you can say, wait a minute. The husband is the sole claimant in this case. He's asking for millions of dollars. Where was he? And so if we think about that on the front end and that becomes part of our case, then we've got a much better chance of winning the case than if we're on our feet trying to figure out what to do with it in trial or 2 weeks before trial or at some other time. We want to neutralize and take care of all that stuff on the front end. And it's easy to do if you know about it on the front end, which the whole point of reverse planning is anticipating all those problems, developing your proof around them. And by, you know, strangely enough, when you do that, and then you say, okay, let's rebut all these things, you have most of your case in chief. Because if we rebut all of those landmines, even though we didn't set out to lay out a prima facie case, we probably have 80% or more of it just in figuring out how to rebut the problems that we might not articulate in the same way as you do in that kind of structured process.
Yeah.
So it's a very intellectual process. There's no smoke and mirrors to reverse planning. It's working hard to figure out what the problems are in the case, including the problems from a juror's perspective, then figuring out how we can make them irrelevant or immaterial.
Yeah, when we worked together, the day one, we had sent you the focus groups and some information about the case, but day one, you forced us to go through and identify all of the landmines, which we did. And it's a very uncomfortable process, of course, because you have to deal with the biggest problems in your case and then systematically figure out how to make them irrelevant or immaterial, or I guess if you can't do those things, to distinguish them or argue them factually, which is the least best approach. That is a very powerful approach that I now use in every case. And I do find it's very effective because it forces you to come to terms with the challenges in your case. Now, I remember in our case, for example, one of the issues was we had a utility lineman who opened a switch that was ungrounded, and they were blaming him for not checking to see that it was ungrounded. And we ended up at trial, and that was a big problem. All the focus groups were very critical of our client for doing that. We turned that completely on its head by trial and made the point that they were the ones who trained him.
Yeah.
And they didn't train him to check. In fact, they had to go back and retrain everybody after that because nobody had been trained that they were supposed to do that. And but without that way to focus on each of those items one at a time and really deal with it, you're going to miss stuff like that.
It's hard to do. I can say, more power too if you can do it yourself. It's really hard to do yourself because it's an ugly process. And it just breaks your heart emotionally, really, to kind of think about and talk about the thing. Because, I mean, we do landmines on the damages, you know? And for the most part, most of the time, if we haven't fallen in love with our client, we like them. We respect them. We honor the way they have dealt with what's happened to them and what's been fate has cast in their path. But it's really hard to do this just on your own. Because, you know, I mean, if it's somebody like me, it's like, I'm just going to say it. And then you or someone else then has to deal with it. And collaboratively, we figure out how do we make it irrelevant or immaterial to what this case is about? Because if we don't do that, we're going to lose. And this person doesn't need to lose because of this really insignificant fact in the overall scheme of things. But so it's a tough process. I think it's tough on lawyers to do. And I think many just, even though they understand the process, aren't capable of doing it because you just have to look long and hard at stuff that's really ugly and is upsetting. And so I usually tell people when we do a landmine session, we spend typically at least a day just on the landmines, like we did with you, Ben. I tell you, at the end of the day, you want to go home and say, why did we take this piece of shit case? You know, it's just terrible because you've been spending the whole day looking at the case through the lens of a defense juror. That's really the easiest way. Look at this case through the lens of a defense juror or a defense attorney, if you want, or a defense-minded judge. Look at the case through that lens. Those are the landmines. And how do we take them out? And what you find out sometimes is, you know, we really can't effectively take out all the landmines, which means this is the case we need to settle. Or maybe we just take a shot, but it's going to be a tough case to win if the landmines come in. And of course, the second component of that is, we're doing the landmines based on, you know, if I'm in a session, I've done hundreds and hundreds of focus groups. So I have an idea what I think people are going to talk about when they hear a fact scenario. But even with that experience, I don't get them all. And when you do a focus group or we do some kind of survey work, all of a sudden we hear and read things that we didn't expect to hear and read. And so, oh, that's an example of we're learning from what potential jurors would actually think or see about the evidence in the case. And even though we might have identified it in a work session, but we might not have put the same amount of importance on it. So a graphic example is I did a birth trauma case, and it was what sometimes would be referred to as a strip case, you know, late decelerations and all that kind of stuff. And it was a strip case. And the baby was born with some terrible problems. They had an expert talking about, you know, they should have done a C-section at this point and let the baby go on for another 6 minutes or whatever it was. And as part of the proof in the case, they had to use suction to get the baby out. And when, of course, when they use suction, the baby's head sort of gets a little cone-like because it's not fully developed. The skull isn't fully developed at that point. And so when the baby came out, it had that little kind of cone head thing. And they put a little knit cap on the baby's head and it looked like a cone head. And so that was part of the evidence in the case that they had to use vacuum extraction. The baby's head was shaped like a little cone and all the rest of that. And that was striking in the context of the doctor denied using vacuum extraction. You know, the nurse who was in the OR said, yeah, we used vacuum extraction. The kid's got, the father who's in the delivery room said he's got the little cone head. They got a picture of the cat. And so we knew all that was there, but the reason the jurors thought all that was important is if the doctor lied about the vacuum extraction, he probably lied about other stuff. And none of us, and it just never occurred to us, when we knew that there was a conflict about him saying, no, I didn't use vacuum extraction, and the nurse in the room saying he did, and we got this. But at the end of the day, the most important thing to the jurors was not the strips. The strips to them were like, that's mumbo jumbo. But he lied about using the vacuum extraction. You know, the vacuum extraction didn't cause any injury. It was just, it was irrelevant to the case. But because he lied about it, that drove the whole verdict. So that was something that we learned in the focus group that we couldn't learn just sitting around because, you know, because of who we are.
Do you have sort of an overarching philosophy of trials that you follow in the different approaches? There have been books written like case framing or reptile or some combination of those approaches, putting aside the deconstruction landmine analysis, but in terms of the affirmative side of the case.
Yeah. In fact, I've got a, let's see if I can pull this up real quickly. There's a number of things that consistently, I mean, whether you're doing focus groups yourself or not is really just, doesn't make any difference. There are certain things that jurors want to know in every case. And every time we do a focus group, they're going to ask about certain things. Regardless of what the facts in the case, there's things that jurors need to know. And the question always is, are we, and regardless, I don't care if you're a TLC person or a framing person or you're eclectic or whatever, it doesn't make any difference. So in every case, when you talk to jurors about the case, they want to know, is there something about this case that's important? Because jurors want to feel that they're doing something important. And so when we are putting our case together and trying our case, is there anything about that case that's going to allow jurors to think that they're doing something important? Because if there is, they're going to be really interested and they're going to focus on that case and they're more likely to deliberate in their favor.
Do you mean important socially or society-wide or just important because it's a very significant case to the plaintiff or the individual involved or both?
Almost always because it's about more than money.
Yeah.
Because the second thing is they want to affect change and send a message. So if they can send a message with the verdict, that's always good for us because then the amount of the significance of the message is measured by the size of the verdict. But they want to feel like they're doing something important. They want to feel like they're able to affect meaningful change, right? And send a message. And the third thing is, so they always ask about that in the focus group. It's like, okay, well, is this just about money? Is this just about making the lawyer and the client rich? Or is this going to change things in some way that's significant? Because that's what they want to do. So when we talk about your case, all right, is this a case where they're going to be able to conclude that they're doing something important, that they're having an opportunity to affect some sort of change and send a message? They want to hear that. And if we can give that to them in the case, that's a really good thing. The second thing is they want to punish wrongdoers or villains, right? And so who's the villain in this case? The answer is, I don't know. But, you know, you're not going to find one if you're not looking for them. And I'm not suggesting you identify someone as a villain. The jurors need to conclude someone's a villain on their own, but they're looking for a wrongdoer because if a wrongdoer doesn't deserve any mercy from them. And so it's like, okay, is there a wrongdoer? Who is it? It's going to be a person. And so we have to start off the case thinking about, okay, who's going to be the target of our attack? Who is going to be the wrongdoer? It's not going to be a corporation. It's going to be a person or a collective of people who made some decisions or some sort of actions. And the extent we can identify those people, and this is an opportunity to send a message and punish them, jurors are happy to do that. So that we hear that in every case. I guess the fourth thing is that they are suspicious of our evidence. They're suspicious of our proof. And so you'll have a uncontradicted proof. Well, it's uncontradicted to us. The lawyer on the other side isn't contradicting. They will. I mean, they'll talk about, you know, was this photoshopped? Was this changed? And so that changes our attitude of how we're going to prove our case. And the way we want to prove our case, through the most part, is we can prove it through what I'll call real evidence. I'll come back to that in just a minute, or through the mouths of defense witnesses. That's the way we want to do it, because that's at least we can minimize the suspicion that's going to sort of encompass our proof. Now, it doesn't mean they're still not suspicious, but our best shot is let's try to address the fact that it's going to be suspicious and give them proof that it is as reliable as we can possibly make it. And that generally means proof that's not aligned with the efforts of the lawyers for the plaintiff. So if you have two kinds of photographs of a scene, one of them is taken by police and one of them is taken by the lawyers or the lawyers' investigators, which one do they think is more credible, right? The one taken by police. It may not be as good, right? If you have a video recreation, okay, or you have a video taken from the convenience store across the street, which one's going to be more credible with the jurors? The video from the convenience store. It is real evidence. It hasn't been manipulated or changed in any way by the parties in the case. And so those are examples of the way, how do we deal with suspicion? They're always suspicious. How do we deal with it? We try to give them evidence that allows us to minimize that suspicion, or at least give our jurors an opportunity to push back when they question, you know, any of our pieces of evidence. And so what's the last thing here? They always want to know, has this ever happened before? They always want to know, I usually describe it as the prior history of the party's conduct, both sides. And so that means they always want to know, in a plaintiff's case, had this person ever had this kind of medical problem, medical complaint, or been treated for this problem in the past? Always, always, always. And so if they're smart, they're going to get a medical history of the plaintiff, and they almost always do. And they will pick it apart looking for prior complaints of back pain or neck pain or headaches or whatever it is, because jurors want to know. Remember, they're suspicious to begin with. And they want to know the prior history of the party's conduct. And if this is a plaintiff complaining of neck pain now and they complained of neck pain in the past, so now we have a bigger problem. So at the same time, they want to know about the prior history of the defendant's conduct as well. The problem is, now that would be OSI or other similar instance, right? It's not that easy to get OSI evidence, number one, and it's not that easy to get it admitted, number two. But if you can get it admitted, if you can find it and you can get it admitted, it's very effective, because people think, okay, you did it before, you saw what happened, you didn't change, now we're going to send you the message. And so those are things every group will ask about in one way. And I say, every group will ask about it. It's not 8 or 10 or 12 people asking. It comes up every time. If you talk to people long enough, they're going to know, did this happen before? And did this person ever had this problem? Did this company ever do this or have this particular problem before? So it's always part of what they want to know. So if you think about, regardless of whatever approach you want to take in terms of your case analysis or case development, bringing into that development the things that jurors consistently want to know about, and then specifically want to know about in your case, like where was the husband, are important things to put together in terms of having really, I think, a solid and effective case.
I'd like to thank our sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno. Steno is a national court reporting service and technology platform that is customized digital technology and platforms to use for secure depositions. And they also have the great added benefit of allowing you to have a deferred payment for all of your transcription and deposition needs. So for plaintiff's lawyers, it means you don't have to pay for those costs until the end of the case. Check them out at steno.com. We're also being brought to you today by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that helps produce our podcast, makes it seamless, takes all of the heavy lifting off the lawyers so you can focus on your law practice and just do the talking into the mic, and they do everything else. Check them out at lawpods.com. Yeah, it's a really great summary. I was actually writing down all those points as you were making them. It's really valuable stuff. And then and on your last point about wanting to know the prior history, it, particularly in the medical malpractice cases, one of the defense tricks is to say this has never happened before. So even if we can't get in the that it has happened, they then try to take advantage of the reverse, which is very powerful for them. So there's a way to avoid that by asking them for prior events. And when they won't give you the information, at least you can prevent them from saying it's never happened in most cases. But
yeah,
what is your approach to voir dire? We've had a lot of guests who've talked about voir dire, and it seems like there's two kind of principal schools of that. Well, one is there's states like my home state, which don't allow for lawyer-directed voir dire or very robust lawyer voir dire, so you can't do much. But in terms of venues where you're allowed to do voir dire, there seems to be a, there's one approach where the idea, I think, is more to develop rapport with the jurors, but with the concept that everybody there can be a good juror for your case. You shouldn't come in overly suspicious about people or really aggressively try to target people, because that tends to build hostility and suspicion among the group, and it could be counterproductive. The other side of the debate is you really have to be aggressive at identifying toxic jurors, people that are going to come in with strong bias against you in your case. And of course, there's lots of variations in between. Where do you come down on voir dire, and what is your approach that you like to teach on that?
Well, you know, the first approach is sometimes called the tribe building approach. It's sort of a TLC approach to voir dire.
Exactly, yeah.
Where, you know, we're all part of the same tribe, and where we want to do the right thing, and I'm okay, you're okay. And there's people that do that very effectively. I'm not one of them. And quite frankly, I don't know many people who are that effective at that approach. I mean, Joe Freed is an example of someone who's very effective at it. And there are other people that are very effective at sort of that tribe building approach to voir dire, where they're not really using I mean, my sense is they're not even using their peremptories. And I'm kind of going, all right, well, if you can do it and you get great verdicts, well, then it's a great approach. I think it's not something I'm able to do. And I think part of it is you just have to be a different person than I am to be able to use that approach, I think, effectively. And so my experience with focus groups tells me there's some people that I don't care what I say, they're bad for the case. Bad for the case. I don't care what, I'm okay, you're okay, they love that, they love you to death. They're still bad for the case. And so we have to find the people that are going to be bad for the case and are going to keep us from getting a just verdict. Find out who they are, and at very least use our peremptories, and we really want to challenge them for cause. So my approach is this, really the second, is let's find the people who cannot return a fair verdict or who are going to disrupt any deliberation that might be directing itself towards a fair verdict for our client with one speculative argument after another, after another, after another. And I think there's people that do that. So yes, so I said, let's identify the people who cannot return a good or bad verdict. Now, the other thing that makes a difference is, you know, I'm in a unanimous jury state, and I consult very often in unanimous jury states. And when you have a unanimous jury, you have to have 12 out of 12. That's a tough, tough, tough jury. And you don't want to leave anybody on that jury who just philosophically, morally, or otherwise is against returning a substantial verdict. So that being said, I've done voir dires in the last 6 months in, I guess, three different states, and one of them, 15 minutes, 15-minute voir dire. So how do you do a voir dire in 15 minutes? And the answer is, well, you better focus on the things that are really important in the case. You can't really get up there and talk about who you are and you know, the importance of juries and how thankful you are that they're there. You got to cut to the heart of the case in a hurry if it's 15 minutes. I'll suggest you do an expand. If you have an hour, you're just going to do an expanded version of this and get more time with the jurors to actually talk about it. But you have to have them talking about the things that make a difference in the case. And so for, I think, the standard of care, if you will, for trial lawyers now who are doing voir dire, is to use slides or PowerPoint to identify and focus on the key issues in the case and talk to jurors about the key issues. So for example, I have a slide that says, and it's a 10-point scale, very uncomfortable, 0, very comfortable, 10. And the title at the top says, returning a verdict if less than 100% sure. And you start off with a hand raise. How many of you are comfortable or very comfortable returning a verdict if you're less than 100% sure? And how many of you are uncomfortable? Okay. And the answer is most people are going to say, most jurors, unless they're 80% sure or more, they're not going to be comfortable returning a verdict. But what we're really trying to do is find the people who just, well, how comfortable would you have to be in this 10-point scale? And if, how uncomfortable? And if they say they're a 1 or a 2 or a 3 in terms of being uncomfortable, that's a bad juror for us because they're not going to be 100% sure. Now, does that mean we want to strike them just based on that one response? No, but if they're uncomfortable returning a verdict of less than 100% sure, you know, we want to talk some more to them. So a second one would, how comfortable are you in returning a verdict for non-economic damages? Very comfortable, very uncomfortable. There's some people that, quite frankly, are not comfortable returning verdicts for pain and suffering or non-economic damage. They just won't do it. So that's a second question. You're going to talk to the entire panel, ask each one of them, ask where they are on a scale, where they are on a scale. Some people, a lot of people are going to be in the middle. Okay, that's fine. But we want to find the people that are at the bad end of that scale, because those are probably going to be peremptories, or we're going to go back and try to strike them for cause. A third one is, if supported by the evidence, how comfortable would you be awarding tens of millions of dollars in a case? Very uncomfortable. And so we're just looking for the people who are bad for us about, one, burden of proof, and two, money damages. But you can also ask other things like, are you more of a big picture or a devil in the details person? Now, that's a slide. That the title is, are you more of a big picture or a devil in the details person? And by the way, Keith Mitnick talks about this very question in Voir Dire. If you look at, I think this is in Don't Eat the Bruises. It might be in Deeper Cuts. But anyway, so on that slide, I have a title, and then I have a line with arrows at each end. And one end says big picture. The other end is devil in the details. And of course, the point is everybody's a little bit of both. But which way do you lean? Are you more of a big picture person, more of a devil in the details person? And we get a repeat of kind of talk about that. Because one of the things we know is devil in the details persons, they're probably not good for plaintiffs.
Yeah, it's interesting because we just did one of those big data surveys in a case, a trucking liability case. And one of the strongest indicators for a bad plaintiff juror was that they like the TV show NCIS.
Yeah.
So I suspect that that maps pretty closely to the devil in the details persona.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering why that would be the case, but I think what you just said explains it.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, so those are examples of just 3 or 4 questions that tell us right away.
Can I ask a question about that? Why do you use the slides? What's the value of the slide as opposed to just asking the question without the visual?
Because it keeps them anchored. It keeps you and it keeps them anchored on the point. Because sometimes what happens, you get a response from a juror that basically ends up being sort of a rabbit trail, and you're tempted to follow it. But the answer is, no, I just want to know, how do you feel about this? Because they want to, well, I don't know, blah, 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 blah. Okay, but if you were picking a number here, and it had to be somewhere on this 10-point scale, what would the number be? Because you can do it politely and really find out where they are. And everybody's clear. Everybody, all 14 people, I mean, in terms of the people in the box and your alternates, they see exactly what the question is. They know exactly where you're going. Are you comfortable returning a verdict if you're less than 100% sure? You know, and then they talk about it. And you find out where they are. And you know, you have some basis for using your peremptories and knowing who's bad for you. And then you get asked questions like big picture versus devil in the details that tells you as well. So example, I think the standard of care, if you will, is going to be eventually that you use those in voir dire consistently. Because it's the best way. By the way, if you can't do voir dire by yourself, I mean, you're obviously standing up there by yourself, but someone else has got to be tracking responses. You can't track the responses because you're connecting with people. You're talking to them. You're making eye contact with them. And so how does your team or your observers make any kind of significant notations about jurors? Well, at least they can, on returning a verdict of less than 100% sure say, well, this person's a 3 and this person's a 2 and this person's a 7, this person's an 8. So you have some sort of measure about who seems to be better for us or worse for us than someone else. And the other thing you can do is you can prime people. Because remember, people already come in, they're already primed to think that the case is about something. And usually they're going to think it's about money. It's about a lot of money. All this is about money, which is why they always want to know, is there something about this case that's important? Is there an opportunity for us to send a message or make a difference? Because they come in thinking it's just about money, which they don't particularly, that's just a waste of their time. They're just making somebody else rich. So you can also voir dire, and I have a slide for this. It says, how many of you, his slide says, suing to make sure something doesn't happen again. How many of you are comfortable with a lawsuit or someone who is suing to make sure something doesn't happen again? How many are uncomfortable with that? All right. Now, everybody says they're comfortable with it. But what that does is we are priming them that this case is not just about money. Before we've ever done opening statement, this is a case that's not just about money. It's about suing to make sure something doesn't happen again. So that's an example of using not the voir dire just for selection or deselection, but for priming in terms of what the case is actually about.
You had mentioned when we started that your process, consulting kind of process, has evolved some since we worked together. Can you tell us the ways in which things have evolved over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest evolution for me probably has been when COVID occurred. You know, you really couldn't do live focus groups. And so I ended up doing, I did some Zoom focus groups, and I'll still do Zoom focus groups if people want to. I don't particularly like them. I mean, it is a way, you know, you can get good information from a Zoom focus group. But if I had a choice between doing a Zoom focus group and a live focus group, I would go with a live one every one for me. But that's just my selfish kind of what I enjoy doing. But I ended up doing surveys. And surveys are really the most robust way to gather opinions, thoughts, and feelings about cases that exist. If you look at market research, there's 3 ways to do market research or opinion research, right? One way is focus groups, right? One way is individual interviews, talk to consumers or people about what they think are the issues of the product or the case. And the third is surveys. So in the United States, in the commercial world, they spend $39 billion a year on opinion research. $39 billion a year on opinion research. They only spend 4% of it on focus groups. And most of their research is quantitative. They're doing surveys. And the reason they're doing surveys is they get much more information and they can do a lot more with the information when they do a survey than we do with focus groups. They may still do focus groups, but they're spending about 69% of their money on surveys as opposed to focus groups, 4% of focus groups, and they do some individual interviews and other things to make up the difference. And the reason to survey, here's what happens on a survey. So I started doing them, I'm doing for several years now. I think they're great. It's my first recommendation for people who want to do opinion research or jury research on a case. Not that we don't do an in-person focus group. I'm happy to do that too. But my first says, let's do a survey, because we give them a neutral narrative of the case, which is sort of when we do landmines or rebuttals, we kind of combine that stuff and says, what's the neutral narrative, the essentials of this case that we want people to know? We capture all their demographic and biographical information. Then what are the questions we want to ask? And there's 2 kinds of questions. There's the open-ended or qualitative question, where they are in their own words explaining why they strongly agree or strongly disagree, or what they think the 2 strongest facts are for the defendant, or the point at which, the tipping point for them, what point in the narrative did they feel, okay, I've kind of made up my mind. So we ask them those open-ended questions, and then we'll ask them scaled questions. And it may be on an anger scale. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 0 to 10, 0 is not anger at all, 10 is very angry, where would you be on that scale? And we get 25, 50, 100 people to put themselves on that anger scale and see how, if they read this neutral narrative, how angry are they? And so they're not all going to be angry, you know, but if the average of 100 people is 7.2, for example, it's like, well, they're pretty pissed off. 100 people, 7.2. You know, there's some people, the reason it's 7.2, we get a bunch of these people who weren't angry at all. And we get to, you know, you end up having all this information is recorded on an Excel spreadsheet. So the person who put a 3 on anger, where everybody else is 8 and 9, we said, who is this person? And we can track back to their name, their age, their gender, their educational level, their income level, their political party, and how they answered every other question. So it's very robust in terms of we get both quantitative information about how many people strongly agree with this point or disagree with this point. So we know in terms of case issues, what's more likely to be a winner for us or not a winner. We know, and we identify people who are probably good for us, probably bad for us. And then we capture all of these narrative responses. So the frustration of doing a focus group is it's 4 hours of talking, and at the end of the talking, what do you have? You know, you have a bunch of impressions, but if I'm moderating the focus group, I'm not taking notes, right? You know, it'll be an interesting conversation, but it's for the lawyers, it's for the clients really to take the notes and come to the conclusions. Now, we'll have some instruments, like little questionnaires, we'll give them during the focus group, so there's some written record. But when we do a survey and ask a question, what were the two most important facts in this case from your perspective for the plaintiff? And we have 50 or 100 written responses. I mean, you basically just copy the column out of the Excel spreadsheet. We paste it in the Word document and says, well, here's the 50 or 100 most important things according to these people in the plaintiff's case. And you read those and say, well, I hadn't thought about that. And they're not, by the way, including what I thought was the most important thing. So you get to capture all the narrative responses of jurors in a way that's just harder to do in a live focus group.
Yeah. And are you doing those surveys yourself through your own consulting firm, or do you work with somebody on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, I work with somebody because it's like you have to recruit the people. So when we do a survey, we recruit to a profile. So in other words, if you are in a particular venue, it says, well, let's recruit people that are likely to be on your jury. And so, or just who do you want? I mean, do you want 50-50 males and females? Do you want more females? What age range do you want? What income levels do you want? Do you want people who are nurses? Do you want people who have CDL licenses? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll recruit to a profile for the survey and then see if it makes any difference.
It's interesting of what you mentioned about the feedback you get. We just did a survey that I was mentioning in a case we're working up toward trial, and there was one issue that 96% of the plaintiff jurors, we had an 88% win rate on the plaintiff side, so it was a very strong case, but 96% of them said it was the most important issue to them. It was not an issue anybody involved with the case had identified prior to the survey. I'm embarrassed to admit, it's very obvious. It was so obvious that we'd missed it, but it was just very, very interesting to see that. And you're just bashed over the head with how significant that is to learn that. So I completely buy into the survey. I think it's incredibly valuable.
The other thing that's good about it is now, because I'm not doing surveys with 1,000 respondents, it's a completely different animal. But so at the end of the survey, people are asked, would you be interested in, our researchers would like to do some follow-up interviews. Would you be interested in doing a follow-up interview? Sort of yes or no. And then we'll give you a $40 Visa gift card for a 45-minute interview. And then what days of the week and what times of day would be good for us, our researchers, to contact you? So 80% of the people respond yes. So what happens, you do the survey. Now you've got a built-in group of people that you can... You can do a Zoom focus group with 4 people in it. You decide who you want to invite. You email them, and you pay them $40 a piece, and you can ask them anything you want. You can have them review. You can have them review documents that they didn't review originally, or look at video clips, or just talk about some issue in the case. So you end up having this sort of group of people that know a little bit about the case. They may not remember everything unless you call them pretty quickly. But they know a little bit about the case, and they are amenable to talking to someone for 45 minutes about the case for $40. And you got their name, address, telephone number, email address, and it's up to you to follow up. But it's a beautiful thing because it's like, when I say it's robust, there's so many things you can do with it. You can do sort of a quantitative review of where are they on a scale on agree, disagree, or how strongly do they feel about particular issues, how sympathetic or angry are they, all that kind of stuff. And you get all the qualitative responses to all those questions you ask about what's important and why, or not important and why. And then you get this ability to follow up with all these people individually, and you know exactly who's amenable to it, and you know what their answers have been. So you can take all the bad people for you and try to find out why they're bad. Because, I mean, someone who's, you can tell on a survey, this is a bad juror for us, right? And then you read the written responses, and you can say, well, this is really a bad juror for us. But you can call them up and find out really why they are a bad juror, or at least have a shot at it. I mean, yeah, this isn't about psychoanalyzing them or attacking them. It's just talking to them about, I appreciate your responses. Tell me, what do you think led to that response versus for another response in terms of your own life? What would you compare this to if you're thinking about your own, whatever you want to do? But the point is, you can actually find out why people are bad or why people are good because you have an opportunity to talk to them afterwards.
Yeah, that's so valuable. And that's a great point that you could follow up with folks. We haven't done that yet, but I think that's a really good idea. So, Philip, thank you so much for joining us. The hour has just flown by. I've got pages of notes here in front of me from our discussions. I learned a ton. If lawyers around the country are interested in working with you on a case or having you help them with their case, how does somebody go about finding you?
Well, I'm on the internet.
Oh my God, no.
Amazing.
Say it isn't so.
Yeah. So
just type your name in there to the Google and you pop up.
I think I'll probably come up. It'll be either me or some sort of cage wrestler or something. I think there's a guy named Philip Miller who is a cage wrestler or a multi martial arts guy. But I'm not him. All of my strengths go into a sort of a different vector than those. So you can find me on the internet, but my email address is pmiller@seriousinjury.com.
Well, thank you, Philip. I appreciate your time today.
Dan, it's good to talk to you. Stay out of trouble, man.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.